What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Julia Dahl, author of the Rebecca Rubin mystery crime novel, Invisible City. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim, Barel Kachar, and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy first day of the Holiday of Lights, Chanukah. We lit the menorah for the first night at sundown yesterday, and we'll be lighting them for seven more great nights of this delightful wintertime festival of dedication. I have always loved Chanukah, the candles, the songs, latkes, family, friends, the great story, the more than a week-long buildup of lights and joy. On Chanukah, we celebrate religious freedom and the victory of the weak over the strong, the righteous over the wicked, the triumph of good over evil. It's a historically important holiday, but it's also just generally a great time. Chanukah also has a very special personal connection for me, and today is the key day. You see, it was in the year 2000 that my best Chanukah story of all took place. My youngest child, my daughter Sipora, was born December 25, 2000, in St. Joseph's Hospital here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. She was born at 5 a.m. The doctor didn't make it on time. The delivery nurse had to do the honors. I guess the doc was too busy wrapping presents that morning. In any case, a couple of hours after Sipora's birth, I'd brought her brothers back to meet her, there was a knock on the hospital room door. It seems that a reporter from the local Kagan 9 News, Karen Gavender, a friend, wanted to film the first baby born on Christmas in St. Joseph's Catholic Hospital here in Tucson, and Sipora Kohan was the one. So I went in the hall and discovered that the reporter was, of course, Jewish. After all, who else works Christmas morning? In fact, she attended my temple, and she asked, "Rabbi, will it be okay to film your daughter?" So I said, "Well, you can film, but you have to say the first baby born on Christmas in St. Joseph's Catholic Hospital in the year 2000 is actually the rabbi's daughter from Temple Emmanuel, and she's the Chanukah baby." Well, that's what they did, and we have this great footage of her when she was just hours old. By the way, for years, Cece was quite sure that all the stores were closed in honor of her birthday, and who was I to argue? Anyway, happy 16th birthday to the Chanukah baby of the year 2000 today on this very first day of Chanukah 5777. My daughter loves musicals, especially the play Hamilton, so in her honor, Fort Sipora, and because it's a brand new Chanukah parody by the extremely talented Maccabees, here's their version of a couple of the wildly successful Broadway show's signature tunes for this festival of lights and latkes, Hamilton as Chanukah.
How does a hazma need you? Son of a priest and a Hebrew, raised in a village with his four brothers in a Judean province ruled by pompous Antiochus. Under pressure, grow up to be a hero and commander.
When the king came around, we said this decree's insane, man. We cannot observe our laws while living in our own land. Fight back like your father, don't forget from whence you came. And we'll call you by a brand new name. What's your name, sir?
Call him Judah Maccabee. The hammer whose aim is true. And we're ready to show the king. We don't know him a single thing. The world will never be the same.
You'll be Greek, soon you'll see. You will pray to Zeus the same as me. You'll be Greek. No need to fight. Our Hellenism serves you right. You won't miss your Shabbat or circumcision for your thoughts. And if you don't comply, I will send my great Seleucid army and you'll tell history goodbye.
That was a group that were past guests of Two Jewish, the Maccabees, doing Hamilton for the holiday of Hanukkah today. One more special birthday greeting, Mazel Tov, to our faithful listener, Gladys Hanfling, who has turned 90 years old. Gladys, may you continue going strong until the age of 120, bis 120. Our guest this morning here on Two Jewish, novelist Julia Dahl, has created a wonderful new crime detective series with the Jewish investigative reporter Rebecca Roberts as her heroine, and improbably but fascinatingly and well-wrought, the Hasidic community of New York as its setting. Meet Julia Dahl when we return in just a moment here on Two Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Hi, my name is Lauriella, and I'd like to tell you how you can help send children like me to a Jewish day school at no cost to you. Arizona allows its taxpayers to receive a tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations such as JETCO. JETCO is the only tuition organization solely dedicated to Jewish education in Tucson. JETCO provides scholarships to children who attend qualified private schools like Congregation Anshai Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, which educates students from grades K through 8th. You may give up to $1,087 for single tax filers and $2,173 for married couples who file jointly. Jewish education nurtures Jewish identity for generations of students like me, so please go online and visit our website at www.jetco.org or give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. And tell them Mariella sent you.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. She's author Julia Dahl, a journalist who specialized in crime and criminal justice, and has written two really fun, interesting novels, Invisible City and Run You Down, both starring the dramatically kind of Jewish, well, I guess Jewish, detective Rebecca Rubin. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Invisible City is really about the invisible Hasidim kind of in the midst of the larger city of New York, but it's about much more than that. Tell us how you came up with the idea of writing a crime mystery novel about that community.
Well, so a couple different things happened at the same time. I've always been a mystery reader since probably before it was appropriate. I was reading Agatha Christie when I was like 8 or 9 years old.
I knew there was a reason I liked you in advance.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's just that's always been my, you know, passion reading, you know, everything from Agatha Christie to Stephen King when I was younger to, you know, John Grisham, and then finding people like Patricia Highsmith and, you know, now Kate Atkinson and Tana French. And so that's always been my genre that I love to read. And I've written fiction since I was a teenager, but it somehow never occurred to me that I could or would write a mystery novel until about a little less than 10 years ago. I was living in New York City, working as a reporter. I just got a job as a reporter for the New York Post, which is a tabloid, big tabloid in New York City. And a couple, what happened was that my now husband, then boyfriend, and I were moving, looking for an apartment, and we went with a real estate agent to an apartment in a neighborhood called Kensington, which I didn't know then, but know now is a very Jewish neighborhood, sort of just north of Borough Park, which is where a big group of Hasidim live. And this is sort of an awful story, but basically the real estate agent told us, I need to tell you before you see the apartment that the man who lived here right before committed suicide in the apartment. And we sort of looked at each other and thought, oh my, you know, okay. But, you know, there was certainly no sign of that in the apartment. And the apartment in New York City, you can't just not take an apartment that's good and cheap and in a nice neighborhood because it has some history.
Yeah, actually, that's a violation of Jewish law not to do that in New York. There's just not much available.
Exactly. And this was a little bit, you know, the price was a little bit good because the apartment had, it was a sort of stigmatized in a way. So we moved in and you know, I became very curious. I'm a reporter. I'm, you know, so I'm sort of curious and nosy, some people might say by nature. And so I started to, well, first of all, I would get his mail because people didn't know he had died. So I started collecting his mail and then I started talking to the neighbors who, through whom I learned that he was a Hasidic man. He was in his 40s and he had grown up in Borough Park, had a wife and children, but he was gay and he'd been shunned but from the community, sort of, you know, had to leave. And that's, you know, and then he died alone in this apartment. And I was sort of, you know, I grew up Reform. I'm from Fresno, California. My mother is Jewish from a, you know, I thought of them as very Jewish, Reform family. And my father's Christian. And in Fresno, I literally had never encountered anyone Hasidic. I didn't even really know that they existed in the country until I moved to New York City. And I kept, you know, I would see them on the subway and see them in my neighborhood and then had this sort of connection with the person in my apartment and thought, you know, they're Jewish like me, but they don't seem to be anything like me. So I just became very curious. I wanted to know who they were. And when you're a writer and you're curious, you sort of start to write. So I thought, I learned a little bit about the community and how it was in many ways very reluctant to talk to the police about uncomfortable things. They like to kind of keep things in the fold like a lot of insular communities do. And I thought, well, what if there was a murder? Would they talk to police? And it sort of just came from there.
And it all comes from there. And looks like it's going to be not just a two book, but a multi-book series. We will talk much more with Julia Dahl, our guest. Her book is called Invisible City. And actually, there's a new one in this series. The sequel is Run You Down. And we will continue in just a few moments when we return here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Hey, Rabbi.
Good morning.
You have a very wide range of ages in your clientele.
Yes, we do. Anywhere from 18 up to 90.
90. So people who are 90 decide they finally want to quit smoking.
Yes, they want to see their grandchildren or their great-grandchildren graduate high school and get married, go to college, that kind of thing.
It's incredible. What's the oldest person you've ever served?
Me personally, I had one that was 90. Last week, I had one that was 88. He's been with us for a couple of years and very, very pleased with how he quit, and his health is getting much better than it used to be.
You can breathe easier. You can smell things. You can taste things that you haven't been able to do so in years.
It's incredible. Where can people go to find out more information?
You can either visit us at our website at freedomsmokeusa.com, or you can call on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
We have four stores around the greater Tucson area. We're in Catalina, Sierra Vista, and we're even in southern Michigan.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows by streaming them from the website or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Chanukah Sameach. Happy Chanukah.
Thank you.
So this is an unusual day. It's first day of Chanukah. It's also, of course, for our Christian neighbors, Christmas Day. And most importantly, it's my daughter Sipora's 16th birthday.
Oh, wow. Mazal tov.
Thank you.
To you, your family, and also to everybody who's celebrating Christmas today.
Chanukah is considered a minor Jewish holiday, but historically it's not minor at all. Without the events of the Maccabean Revolt, there would not have been any Judaism. It was sort of enforced paganism, part of the whole encounter with Hellenism. And if we couldn't have worshipped the one God, there wouldn't have been Judaism after 2,200 years ago, approximately. And that probably means there wouldn't have been Christianity to celebrate today, let alone Islam or all of Western civilization.
Right. It's an interesting question. If Judaism had disappeared a couple of centuries before Jesus lived, would Christianity have been born? I mean, it's a really interesting question. So maybe Christianity owes its existence to the Maccabean Revolt. And
yeah,
maybe,
I think so.
Maybe Christians should learn what Hanukkah is really about, that it's not the Jewish equivalent of Christmas. It has nothing to do with the winter solstice or anything else. I mean, there is this false equivalence. Everybody wants to be politically correct, and they say, Happy Holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, whatever. These things have nothing to do with each other.
That's correct. So the truth is, Hanukkah is about a victory for religious freedom, and it's about a military victory, a guerrilla war, maybe the first successful guerrilla war in history against a much more powerful enemy. And it was an assertion that people had the right to believe as they wish to believe, even if they were under a greater
power.
Or
more importantly, to practice their religion as they wish to practice, which is something that's coming under assault today, increasingly around the world, when it comes to Muslim women covering their heads, for example.
Right. Right.
It's not only a question of belief, it's a question of practices based on those beliefs. And to what extent does the state have the right to say, if you want to live in this society, you can believe whatever you want, but you can't practice certain things? I mean, that is a hot political topic. It's related to what we discussed in the preceding 2 weeks, very much so in Europe. May someday be related to similar questions in our own country. But, I mean, what you're referring to, of course, is when the Greek Empire was at its height. It included what is now the state of Israel. And one particular Greek king had a strong dislike of Jewish belief and practice and sort of banned Jewish practice, burned Jewish books, burned Torah scrolls, and poured pig's blood over holy objects in the temple.
As a way of defiling them, preventing
right.
Jews from worshiping.
So there was this band of outlaws, guerrilla warriors, whatever you want to call them, who became Jewish heroes over the ages. We sing about them, we praise them, whatever. But it's considered a minor holiday because it's post-biblical. This whole story of the Maccabees doesn't appear in the Bible. It appears in the Apocrypha. And I think maybe next week we should talk about the difference between a minor holiday and a major holiday and what Jews can and can't do. And it's not about the length of the holiday. It's not about the importance of the event it commemorates. It's really about whether it's biblical or not.
Pretty much.
And whether it's related to the temple and the pilgrimages or not.
Right.
So we can get into that maybe next week.
Let's talk about that next week. But in the meantime, Hanukkah, while a minor holiday, sure is observed in a big way in America. Thanks, Tom. Happy Hanukkah.
Same to you.
We welcome our Shin Shin, our Israeli representative to our community, Bar Al-Kacher. Bar, Chag Sameach, Chag Chanukah Sameach.
Chag Sameach, Sameach, Rabbi.
Happy holiday of Chanukah. We say Chag Urim Sameach, the great holiday of lights.
Why not?
So I know how we celebrate it in America. We eat a lot of latkes, we light candles, we sing lots of songs, we give lots of presents. Israel's a little bit different, though.
A little bit different. We still eat lots of latkes, we still sing lots of songs.
Sufganiyot.
Yeah, Sufganiyot is much. I haven't seen a lot of them here, you know?
Yeah, we don't really make them. In Israel, Sufganiyot are kind of jelly donuts, but they're heavier,
yeah,
and they go directly into your arteries to clog them.
Exactly.
But they're delicious.
So we have those too, of course, but only because it's the holidays. But more what I've seen in Israel is that everybody's out of their house. If you go to somebody else's, like you go to your friends in your neighborhood, everybody's not around. Everybody's traveling. Everybody's seeing family. And everybody's mostly not home because they're hiking and they're doing with their families Hanukkah. Like my family, what we do is we always hike up north or down south at the desert or in the mountains. And we just do the Hanukkah nights with the candles and with the singing and with the latkes and with the artery. we do it outside, and we do it with friends of our family. We travel, we go to camps and we like camping, and we just have fun there with our friends. And that's what I think it's all about.
You know, when you think about it, the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, right. I'm sure they did a lot of camping out.
Yeah, that was fun. From what I heard, they did a lot of camping out at caves, and from there, you know.
Right. So, you know, the other aspect of Hanukkah that I think doesn't translate as well in America, or maybe it does a bit, but it really means something in Israel, is the whole military aspect of it. You know, when we think about it, Jews don't have so many great military heroes. You know, after King David, it's a long wait until you get to the Maccabees, and then it's a really long wait until you get to 1948. But Israel is really oriented towards that. What do the Maccabees mean as a symbol of Jewish fighting?
I think that's a very good point. A lot of people in Israel call it Chag Gvura, like the holiday of bravery, exactly, because it talks about all the great things when you talk about small versus big army, the people who are resilient.
Like the few defeating the many,
exactly.
The weak
it's
defeating
like
the strong.
It's just like all the Hollywood movies.
Yeah, it's like all the Hollywood movies, and it's like the War of Independence, and it's like the Six-Day War, and it's like the
Yom Kippur everything War. Connects to. Everybody connects to this idea of bravery, and everybody says that this Gvura, these people who had a really tough time and in the end, you know, won and took over and the house of Hashmonai ruled over Israel. That's something that hasn't been seen again and is amazing to see. And everybody, I'm not a father yet, but all the
when you become a father,
all the moms and dads tell their children about how amazing this ride has been and how the Maccabees were so brave and took over the land. And that's a lot of stories that people tell their kids. And I think it's a really important part of Hanukkah, you know,
and it relates, I think, very much to the contemporary Israel, you know, the sense of a small country surrounded by great enemies or lots of people, you know,
it couldn't be any more true today.
Right. Yeah. Well, Chag Orim Sameach, a happy holiday of Hanukkah. And if you can't camp out, at least light some good candles.
All right, I'll try.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Benasher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John, and Chag Chanukah Sameach.
Boker Or, thank you very much. Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Holiday of Lights. We think about Hanukkah as a time of celebration, latkes, dreidel, all kinds of fun stuff.
Miracles,
candles. But actually, it's a time of gratitude and thanksgiving.
Absolutely. You know, we reflect on how fortunate we are to continue to be a thriving people, not just surviving. And at this time of year, you know, we're celebrating with family, with friends, also in Tucson, appreciating how great it is to be here. So there are many things to be grateful for. And you could even think of Hanukkah as an opportunity for 8 nights of gratitude.
Oh, I really like that. So let's start by saying we're grateful that we're not under like 10 feet of snow.
That's right. Grateful for Tucson and all the great weather.
When you teach about it, when we talk about it to our kids, how do you get them to start with gratitude? You know, we're so used to getting things, to a commercial society, big focus on all that stuff.
Right.
That's not really about feeling grateful.
Right. And there are lots of opportunities to think about our lives. And yes, you know, there are two sides to every coin, but there is so much to be grateful
even
for.
Even a Hanukkah gelt coin.
Bada boom. And so how do you teach that in an educational system? It's the kind of thing that needs a lot of attention and kind of the constant reminder. So over the course of a year, a system might identify specific areas of focus or values to be emphasizing. So for example, at THA, we have an attitude program, which is really positive and helps us really focus on 10 core values. One of them is gratitude. And so for a month, we put a focus on this concept, and teachers work together to build build lessons to help kids understand what being grateful means, what it looks like, what it sounds like, what behaviors you do to show gratitude. And then they put those things to work. Students might write post-it notes about something they saw, a quality they admire in someone else, or something good that they saw somebody do. Maybe a peer was helpful. So they'll drop a note in the jar, and then the notes are read out to class as examples of being grateful.
What do you feel most grateful for at this time of Hanukkah?
Wow, that's such a big question. I get these big questions, and I guess my first answer is wow.
That's a good stalling tactic, I might add.
Yes, I'm grateful for my children. I'm grateful for being in a great place in life. I'm grateful for being 49 and feeling hale and healthy. And I'm grateful for a wonderfully supportive community that is behind my organization and is behind everyone's success there.
We're grateful for you, John.
Oh, thank you so much.
Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy Hanukkah filled with light and joy and gratitude.
Chag Sameach.
When we return on To Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. As the El Al plane settled down at Ben Gurion Airport in Israel, the voice of the captain came on. Please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened until this plane is at a complete standstill and the seatbelt signs have been turned off. To those of you who are remaining politely in your seats, we wish you a Merry Christmas. To those of you standing in the aisles, struggling to pull presents you bought overseas out of the overhead compartments, we wish you a happy Hanukkah. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. In this week's portion of Miketz, we're in the midst of the fabulous story of Joseph, shorn of his technicolor dream coat and now locked away in an Egyptian prison. Dreams play a central role, not for the first time in Genesis and not for the first time in this Joseph story. In Miketz, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, dreams a famous dream. Seven fat cows emerge from the Nile River and then are eaten by seven skinny cows. Then seven fat ears of grain are devoured by seven lean ears of grain. The Pharaoh wakes up puzzled and disturbed. What does it all mean? None of the Egyptian king's brilliant advisors or counselors can help him. In desperation, he turns to a forgotten Hebrew prisoner who once helped his chief wine steward, that is his bartender, when he was in jail. It is Joseph, the Hebrew slave, long forgotten. And so Joseph's dragged from prison, cleaned up, brought to the Pharaoh, who is perhaps the most powerful man in the whole world. Joseph hears the Pharaoh's dreams and correctly interprets them, prophesying 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. Giving full credit to God for being his only source of insight, Joseph helps the Pharaoh save Egypt, and things go well both for him and Egypt. He rises to great prominence, second in command of the country, and the Pharaoh's power is multiplied while his people are saved from destruction. The story doesn't end there, of course. Joseph marries and has two children, but oddly, his great success, his power and fame throughout Egypt, and his new family aren't quite enough for Joseph. He misses his father, left behind in Canaan. He pines for his younger brother Benjamin, the only living reminder of their dead mother, Rachel. He never expects to see his father and full brother again. In a word, he's a bit depressed. And then, in a plot twist worthy of our finest novels, his brothers are compelled by famine to come down to Egypt to buy bread. Suddenly, the same characters who beat him and sold him into slavery are completely in his power. What an amazing opportunity for revenge! In this week's portion of Miketz, Joseph takes advantage of that. He teases and torments his brothers. He is fully aware of their identity, and they are completely ignorant of his. It's a game of cat and mouse, and Joseph seems to relish manipulating, teasing, emotionally torturing his brothers. What will happen? As the portion of Miketz concludes, we're left wondering just which way it'll all go. Next week, we get the answer. But this week, the issue is delineated. How exactly does an assimilated Jew respond to the pressure to continue to hide his identity? Just as the Jews in the days of the Maccabees struggled with the tremendous pressure to accept cultural subjugation and give up their Judaism, so too Joseph struggled with hiding his identity or admitting it in public. No matter how prominent we may become, the pressure to assimilate, even hide our Judaism, can be overwhelming. In a season when the majority culture can overwhelm with songs, foods, and religious trappings, we Jews today sometimes struggle to remember our pride in our own Jewish identity. May we learn from the lessons of both Joseph and the Maccabees that Jewish identity has to be asserted proudly and with commitment, even in the darkest of days. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, author Julia Dahl, will explain why she focuses so much on the Hasidic community and how that's helped shape her excellent mystery novels. Find out when we return here on To Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high school, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
President-elect Donald Trump will nominate campaign advisor David Friedman, a bankruptcy lawyer with hardline views on Israel, who was Trump's own bankruptcy lawyer when his Atlantic City casinos went under. David Friedman will be the new U.S. ambassador to Israel. Friedman said he looked forward to moving the U.S. embassy to Israel's eternal capital, Jerusalem. That would fulfill a promise made by Trump on the campaign trail that he would relocate the diplomatic mission from Tel Aviv. Multiple presidents, both Republican and Democrat, have made similar promises, only to back away from them after being elected. Friedman has long held conservative positions on Israel. Earlier this year, he called supporters of J Street, the progressive Jewish advocacy group, worse than capos for supporting a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Capos, of course, were Jews in Nazi concentration camps put in charge of other inmates. Eesh. David Friedman was Trump's key campaign advisor on Jewish affairs. It remains to be seen what actual policies Trump's administration will advocate in the Middle East. But at least on this appointment, the Israeli government should feel substantially reassured. Even if the nominee for Secretary of State is the CEO of ExxonMobil Oil Company, with very strong ties to Russia and in the Arab world, neither of which are exactly fans of Israel. In his final address to the UN Security Council, outgoing Secretary General Ban Ki-moon recognized that Israel is subject to strong bias in the UN, something Israeli ambassadors, including current Ambassador Danny Danon, have stated loudly for years. Decades of political maneuverings have created a disproportionate volume of resolutions, reports, and conferences criticizing Israel, Ban Ki-moon said. In many cases, rather than helping the Palestinian cause, this reality has hampered the ability of the UN to fulfill its role effectively. Danon replied, "The Secretary General admitted the clear truth. The UN's hypocrisy towards Israel has broken records over the past decade. During this time, the UN passed 223 resolutions condemning Israel, while only 8 resolutions condemned the Syrian regime as it massacred its citizens over the past 6 years. That's absurd. With a new Secretary General set to take office next month, we look forward to the possibility of a new era of fairness at the UN." The outgoing Secretary General chose to speak about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in his last speech at the Security Council because, in Ban's words, "While the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not the cause of the wars in the Middle East, its resolution can create momentum for peace throughout the region." From his mouth to God's ears. "The right of the Jewish people to have a state does not negate the right of the Palestinian people to statehood," Ban added. "At the same time, Israel must realize that the reality in which a democratic state governed by the rule of law keeps the Palestinian people under military occupation will continue to generate criticism and call for accountability. Progress in this area, however, will be difficult unless the Palestinian authorities take brave and concrete steps to address incitement and violence," he added. Again, only if God wants it. Ban Ki-moon slammed Hamas for its anti-Semitic charter that aspires to the obliteration of Israel. "Hamas must, once and for all, renounce the use of violence and recognize the right of Israel to exist alongside a Palestinian state, in accordance with all relevant Security Council resolutions and previous agreements between the parties." And finally, the inventor of the Heimlich maneuver, Henry Heimlich, died last week at the age of 97. The former director of surgery at Jewish Hospital in Cincinnati, Heimlich was married to the daughter of the founder of the Arthur Marie Dance Studios. The son of Hungarian Jewish immigrants, Heimlich, an innovative and charismatic guy, first developed a valve that saved the lives of those with battle wounds to the chest from strangling to death in blood. It saved many soldiers during the Vietnam War. After choking deaths became a national story in the 60s, Heimlich invented a simple functional maneuver anybody could perform. He first published the technique in an article in the magazine Emergency Medicine in 1974, and to help overcome strong resistance from the established medical community, the highly entertaining doctor brought his case for adopting the Heimlich maneuver, named by himself, to the public. He appeared on Johnny Carson and lots of other shows and many speaking engagements. The Heimlich maneuver was eventually accepted as the best way to save the life of somebody who's choking. It's been credited with saving the lives of many celebrities, Ronald Reagan, Cher, who was actually saved by director Robert Altman, Carrie Fisher, John Chancellor, who was saved by Tom Brokaw, Mayor Ed Koch, and Dick Vitale among them, as well as many thousands of ordinary people around the world. In May of this year, Heimlich, then 96 years old, finally used the maneuver for the first time himself, saving the life of an 87-year-old woman choking on food at his senior living center. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Julia Dahl, is a journalist who has become a crime detective mystery author, author of Invisible City, which won a whole bunch of awards and Run You Down, and a new book coming out, Conviction, will be published early in 2017, starring Rebecca Roberts, the Jewish, although not terribly experienced, Jewish reporter who becomes a sleuth. We started talking about the way that you got into writing about, first of all, the Hasidic community based on having rented an apartment with a guy who committed suicide, and because he had left the Hasidic world. That plays an important part in your series. Can you explain how that has worked for you?
Yeah, you know, at the beginning, I just wanted to learn about sort of who the Hasidim were. But as I started trying to research, I realized that it was going to be very hard for me to sort of, you know, you can't just like knock on the door of a Hasidic family and say, you know, I'd like to learn more about you. It's a very insular community. And so one of the ways that I started learning about the community was to reach out to people who had left. So they grew up in this world and knew it well, but for many reasons, decided that it wasn't for them. And so they were living more modern lives and more open to talking to a reporter who was doing research. And I just became fascinated, not just with the Hasidic culture, which I already was fascinated with, but with the culture of people who had left that world, because it's very, you know, depending on what sect you were brought up in, it can be incredibly insular. And, you know, I mean, we're talking about people who don't know, literally had never heard the word dinosaur. You're not allowed to read books or watch television. And you're living in this sort of very cloistered community inside New York City, the most cosmopolitan, diverse city in the country. And the struggles that these people were going through, not having proper education, not really understanding the world around them, and also being very frightened of the world around them, because a lot of Hasidim grow up, it's a community very directly descended from Holocaust victims and survivors. And there's a fear in the community, a sort of very palpable sense that that the outside world can turn on us at any moment. And so many are taught to fear people who are not like them. So how do you leave that community with, your family deciding they don't, saying if you don't observe, we will not be in contact with you. You don't have education. You maybe are afraid of people. It's a really tough road. And I met a lot of people some who were thriving, but most who were really struggling. And I just became friendly with them and learned about their struggles. And Run You Down, the second book, is in many ways more about the community of people who've left, because I was so fascinated with their struggles.
Rebecca's mother is Jewish, Hasidic. Her father, Christian, and her mother is one of those people who's left the community. And then in the second novel, in Run You Down, you kind of follow her story. In the first, she's almost, a wraith. She keeps kind of being part of it. Her daughter's trying to find her. Where did you go with the third? I don't want to give away too many secrets, but tell us a little bit how you developed it that way.
Well, the third is, I'm actually really excited about the third, because it's different. It's still Rebecca. We get, her perspective, and her mother's in her life. I won't say too much about that peripherally, but it focuses a lot on the sort of mystery of the novel is about a murder, a family that is murdered in the aftermath of the Crown Heights riots. The Crown Heights riots were in 1991, and the murder takes place in 1992. And I became fascinated a little bit with that because, again, the Hasidic community in Crown Heights, which is a neighborhood that is really almost at the time, it was very heavily black, mostly sort of Caribbean American and Hasidic. And it was not a community that meshed well together, to put it, mildly. And there was a lot of sort of trauma there, but also a lot of people sort of trying to cross lines and reach across that boundary. So I wanted to do a cold case. And if you've read either of the novels, you know that the character of Saul is
a fascinating character.
He's based on someone that I met in researching, a man, an Orthodox man, who was a captain in the NYPD and has, struggled to sort of live that double life. But the crime that happens, that sort of the book is based around, this third book, is a crime that Saul investigated at the beginning of his career. And so Rebecca is sort of forced to look back at that crime. And I'm really excited about it because for the first two books, the books are told entirely from the first person, either from Rebecca's point of view or her mother's. And the third book sort of opens up a little bit and we get more perspectives, which as a writer was really fun for me because I really can't, I really don't want to write the same book over and over again in exactly the same voice. I want not just to challenge myself, but I just want to do something different. I get bored. And so it was really fun to be able to take on the voices of several other characters. And I'm going to do that again now. I've just started writing the fourth Rebecca Roberts book. I don't think that gives away too much, but it's a different kind of book, and I'm really excited about it.
It's too early to be tired of your characters, but as someone who grew up with Sherlock Holmes and Agatha Christie, and Conan Doyle really wanted to kill off Sherlock Holmes, and he tried to do it, and his readers wouldn't let him. Can you see yourself becoming, you know, you're just having great success with this. I'm sure it doesn't feel like this, but can you see the possibility of becoming imprisoned in that voice?
Yes. And, you know, in a way that I felt that when I started this third book, I felt like I don't want to do the whole thing in Rebecca's voice. I'm just less interested in her than I am in some of the other characters right now. And, you know, not to say that I wouldn't then write a whole other book in Rebecca's voice in the future, but yeah, you know, I started writing Invisible City in 2007, and it, at the time, until I really finished it, which was many, you know, 5 years later, I didn't anticipate that I would be writing a series. I thought I was just writing one book. And then by the end of the book, I realized, oh, we need to at least do a sequel. And then I was lucky enough that my publisher wanted to make it into a series. So, you know, 10 years ago, it did not occur to me that I would be writing about the same person 10 years later. I love Rebecca, and I love that, you know, writing a reporter, like writing a detective or a cop, allows you to enter so many different worlds. You know, she can go take a fellowship in France and solve a murder there, or, you know, go to Hawaii, or, you know, anywhere. But yes, I do feel like I'm writing this fourth Rebecca Roberts book now. And I think that while I hope to come back to her, I think that after that, I may try to do something totally different for my fifth book.
You are not the first author to say something like that. I guess I have to ask this about almost every author. How much of Rebecca Roberts is you?
Okay, yeah. So there are definitely things about Rebecca that are very much like me. I am the child of a Christian father and Jewish mother. So sort of navigating the identity of Christian and Jewish, what does it mean to be one? What does it mean to be the other? What does it mean to be both, to be neither, is something that I've sort of struggled, is the wrong word, but sort of thought about my whole life. And it's a big part of my identity, being both in a way. And Rebecca has that. Now, my mother did not abandon me as Rebecca's mother did. So she has that hole in her in a way that I don't. But she's also a reporter. I'm a reporter. But I think she's an angrier person than I am. Probably, you know, at some level, because she was abandoned, and she's felt like she's sort of always had to fight to be loved in a way, to be felt, to be taken care of. She's also in a lot of ways braver than I am. She's someone I wish I was and am glad I'm not at the same time. She's also younger than I am. I started working as a tabloid at a tabloid when I was 30, and Rebecca's only about 22 when this all starts. And one of the things that I wanted to do in this book was to explore sort of the perils of doing journalism with very little oversight as a very young person. There were a lot of people I was working with at the Post who were right out of college, and we had very little supervision and guidance, but we were doing these really very ethically and morally kind of challenging jobs. And I wanted to put someone young in a position that I was in a lot, but as a slightly older person, where I'm having to make difficult decisions and do slightly dangerous things, but, you know, I'm just out of college. So I like I said, you know, we have a kinship, but I wouldn't do a lot of what she does.
Well, you know, the way you portray the life of a stringer, which I assume is based on your own experience of working for tabloids, it's a kind of precarious existence, isn't it?
Oh, very. I mean, it's not a, for most people, it's a full-time job, but it's not a staff job. So, you know, you don't have any benefits, you're paid a day rate. Every day you literally, just as Rebecca does, you call into the office and they tell you where to go. And it could be Long Island, or it could be the Bronx, or it could be downtown Manhattan, or it could be, you know, I mean, it's every day you're in a different place. And it's wonderful as a reporter, as a journalist. I mean, you get, if you're at all nervous about talking to strangers or knocking on doors, I mean, you get over that immediately. You also, it was such an amazing way to learn New York City. I mean, I have been in every neighborhood and every kind of home and every kind of, you know, talk to every kind of person. But it is definitely not steady. And it's, you know, you can't tell where you're going to be from one day to another. So it's only a certain kind of person that would thrive doing that. But I could only do it. I did it for 3 years. And that was that was enough for me.
You know, it's funny. It's almost like in the books, it's sort of the contrast of almost between the hard-boiled op dealing with a Hasidic community. I don't know how else to describe it, because you get a lot of the grittiness of the experience and then this very embracing but also suffocating culture in contrast. Was that intentional?
Yeah, I mean, I think the culture of the Hasidim is something that I still, you know, it's funny, I've written now three of these books that involve the Hasidim, but I still don't feel like I really, really understand them. And I don't think that I ever will, not having grown up in that world. But it's just a community that I'm sort of endlessly fascinated with, and that for many people works. I mean, I know many people who are very happy in their life, and their, you know, women who have 5 and 6 and 7 and more children and who love that life. I mean, that is not something I could do. But it is, you know, it's one of the richness of the world, of course, is that people thrive in different ways. And even though I do have sort of, some problems with some of the ways that the community functions, and I tend to think that, I'm a journalist, so to me, transparency and openness and shining light into dark places is, you know, that's as much my religion as anything else. But what's been fun about this project and what I didn't expect is that I've come to have much more empathy and respect for the community than I did when I started. I had a real chip on my shoulder about the community. I thought, those miserable women, those awful men, and oh, what if they, you know, this so anti-feminist, and in a way, you know, in a way it is still, but I feel like I have grown up a little by understanding why people want to live like that.
And a final question, has this changed your perception or your own Jewish experience?
You know, it has in a way. I'm a very mostly non-observant Jew. I always have a Passover Seder and I celebrate Hanukkah, and I usually go to synagogue, usually is probably exaggerating, every other year go to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah.
By the way, that might match the description of most Reformed Jews that belong to synagogues in America.
Right. I mean, I'm not exactly the Bagels and Woody Allen, you know, but Jew. But I think more than anything, it's just cemented in me the pride I have in it. I talk a little bit about, I sometimes talk to synagogues, you know, about the book, and you know, I talk about how as a older person, I've chosen to identify as Jewish, whereas my father is a Christian. He's actually a minister. And the reason, there are many reasons I chose, but one of the main ones is that my grandmother, I was very close to my grandparents who were Jewish. And I remember my grandmother saying, "Julia, there are enough Christians in the world. We need more good Jews." And I agree, but I also feel like Christianity, you can choose in a way, you know, if you want to convert to Christianity, you know, you can just sort of go for it. But Judaism to me feels like something that is given to me. And I can't imagine rejecting that. It's like embracing a history of, that's a history of both oppression and fear and beauty and worldliness. And I want to embrace that. So as even if I'm not terribly religious, it's something that I feel like I've grown more close to. I also wish a little bit that there was, I was a little more, I don't know if observance not exactly right, but I've been now to several Hasidic sort of events, bar mitzvahs and weddings, and watching the men dance together was one of the most moving things I've ever seen in my life. It just, this joy and this sort of expression of culture and religion that isn't a part of my daily life was something that I was so glad it's still a part of many people's lives.
I want to thank Julia Dahl for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her books are called Invisible City and Run You Down. People can go to your website. Can you give us that website, please?
It's www.juliadahl.com. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter and Goodreads and all that good stuff.
All the good stuff. And her books are available at Amazon and everywhere books are actually sold, if there are any actual places books are sold, as opposed to online. Dahl, by the way, is DAHL. Thanks so much, Julia, and happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Tammy Rossman Benjamin, co-founder and president of Amcha, which fights anti-Semitism and anti-Israel activity on college campuses. She is a co-winner of the 2017 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award, which will be presented at Temple Emmanuel in January. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website and friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes for Hanukkah, whose first day we're enjoying with seven more nights to come. It's past guest Michelle Citrin's song, Left to Right. My friends, have a Chag Chanukah Sameach, Chag Urim Sameach, a very happy holiday of Hanukkah, and a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Tonight we light the Hanukkah candles from left to right.
Left to right.
We celebrate our victory, we celebrate our rights. First you take a single candle and you start a...
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.